linoleum knife.
Guess whose week it was to pick the music?
Mine. So great. It's always great when I pick the music.
Always. So great.
It was super great just then.
Yes, so great. So this is a podcast about movies.
Don't you want to know about the music that I picked? Don't you care?
I'm sure somebody out there does. So, and who knows if Shazam even has that. So what was it?
I don't think Shazam... I mean, you could try it when we're done recording the show. You could try Shazamming that. I'll put it back in the cassette player.
Listeners are already stopping and rewinding and Shazamming it themselves.
No, they're not. It was Red Transistor. Yeah.
Great.
It's pretty great. So great.
You're Dave White of movies.com.
Don't you want to know who Red Transistor is?
And I'm Alonzo Duraldi of therap.com.
I'm going to tell you anyway.
And What the Flick on YouTube. Who's Red Transistor, Dave? He's dying to tell us.
Led by a guy named Rudolph Gray, who's a musician. Clearly.
Shouldn't they have been Gray Transistor?
Sort of a no-wave kind of New York dude. Also, a writer. Guess what book he wrote? Nightmare,
50 Shades of Grey.
Nightmare of Ecstasy, a biography of Ed Wood.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
See?
Didn't
back.
You, I was leading you. I was leading
they.
You to knowledge.
And yes, you did.
Like a horse unto oats.
And I love oats. And Hall. So big week of movies, but also sadly big week of celebrity deaths. Edie Gourmet passed away this week. Marilyn King, the last of the King sisters.
You might have to explain who the King sisters were.
Okay, well, the King family singers were a very blonde and toothy combo. It was mainly the four sisters, but when they got their own TV show on ABC. In the 60s, they started trotting out the King family, and there would be cousins and sons and daughters. My main connection with them is through the Christmas specials that they did in the 60s, which were pretty amazing. I have a DVD of King family Christmas specials.
We watch the DVD of those specials.
They're
at Christmas
amazing.
Time, and they're pretty dope.
Like, there's one where one of the sisters is singing I'll Be Home for Christmas to a picture of her son who is in Vietnam. And then before the song ends, he shows up on stage and surprises her. And he totally catches her off guard.
And she was completely surprised because they kept it a secret from her.
And so she's like half crying and half and finishes the song.
She finishes the song. She just belts it. Yeah.
And then there's this whole crazy thing with like where all the kids did like these two sort of old English like wassailing songs or something while they're kind of creeping through the house, and it's like the most complicated vocal arrangement you've ever heard. The adults are like half laughing at how bizarre the whole thing is,
and the outfits are really groovy.
I'll post a link on our Facebook page, the King Family Christmas DVD. You get your hands on this thing. It's amazing.
One of the King
died. Yes, Marilyn King passed away this week.
She was the last one.
Yeah, she was the youngest.
Yeah.
Like, I think she was born the year that the family started performing. And then I think she was sort of a backup for the one singer who wasn't an actual sister. And then when she got old enough, she became a permanent part of the act.
Oh.
I have to dig this up. One of them was married to... I always forget who. One of the four sisters was married to... this guy who invented, like, not the Moog, but he was an inventor of some sort of electronic synthesizer or some kind of instrument or the vocoder or something crazy like that. Anyway, the King family, they're fascinating. And, they're probably all gay haters, but who knows? Maybe not.
I can't imagine.
In fact, I think based on the documentary I've seen, I think there's some gays in the King family.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a hunch.
I don't see that
not.
They're from the old school, obviously, but...
you're right. I'll give them more credit.
Talk about other deaths.
The Kings were awesome. But anyway, the big one this week was Karen Black. She was nominated for an Academy Award for her heartbreaking supporting role opposite Jack Nicholson in Bob Rafelson's Five Easy Pieces. She starred in Robert Altman's Nashville and come back to the Five and Dime Jimmy Dean in Day of the Locust. She was Myrtle in the 1974 The Great Gatsby.
Airport 1975.
Gypsy 83, the gay indie from the guy who wrote Edge of 17. You know, she's been
a Trilogy of Terror.
Yes, of course. She was briefly married to L.M. Kit Carson, who was one of the writers, I want to say, of Easy Rider, and their son Hunter. She co-starred opposite her son Hunter in a remake of Invaders from Mars that Toby Hooper did in the '80s. Fascinating performer, because she was very much a product of the new Hollywood, the 1970s. You know. The hippies shaking up the studio system, and the, you know, anybody with a beard and a script got, you know, could make a movie. You know, she was in Easy Rider. She was in Five Easy Pieces. She was a key player for a lot of these sort of movies that really changed the film industry in the 1970s. And I don't know that old Hollywood necessarily knew what to do with her. I mean, they put her in Airport 1975, which is a sort of stodgy and stolid, a sort of big Hollywood all-star cast kind of movie is. Yeah. Probably mainly off the strength of having been an Oscar nominee, because Irwin Allen loved to load up with Oscar nominees or Oscar winners in these movies.
Right.
But, you know, clearly landing the plane opposite Charlton Heston is not exactly why Karen Black was a movie. I mean, she was great, but it's...
She was terrific.
She was not exactly in her main wheelhouse.
Well, nobody in that movie was being asked to do much. There goes my kettle.
Your kettle is a-brewing.
Tell more things about her.
So, you know, she...
Tell about the one we saw in Nashville at the Academy. She sang. I will. Started singing.
You know, she was always a... you know, when you would read interviews with her or see her in person, she always seemed to give off a very... that kind of capital A actress vibe of somebody who was very... in touch with you know, her own sort of inner wackiness. And she was always a very striking-looking woman. I mean, very beautiful, but at the same time, she always was just that teensy bit cross-eyed. So she wasn't sort of a, you know, run-of-the-mill kind of glamour girl. But yeah, so Dave and I went to the Academy in... I guess like 2001, I guess, 2000, whenever the 25th anniversary of Nashville was. I guess it was 2000. And so on the stage at the Academy Theater on Beverly Boulevard, I mean, literally, from one side of this very wide stage to the other, there was a row of chairs, and it was pretty much every living cast member of Nashville except for Lily Tomlin, I think. Yeah. I mean, everybody was there. You know, Henry Gibson was there, and Keith Carradine, and Shelley Duvall, and you know, Ronnie Blakely, and I mean, just that's
Barbara Harris was not there.
Barbara Harris was not there. That's true, but a huge lineup of amazing actors and actresses who were in that film, and they were arranged alphabetically. So Karen Black, I think, was like first, and they sort of went down the row and had kind of each person sort of share their memory of, you know, getting cast in the film or how they got involved or meeting Altman or whatever. And she talked about going into audition for Altman and how, I guess because she had played a character in Five Easy Pieces who was not a very good singer, like she spends the whole movie sort of semi-tunelessly warbling Tammy Wynette songs, I guess Altman thought that she couldn't sing, so she had to convince him in the audition that she could indeed sing. And then in the course of telling this story, she starts singing.
It was great.
On stage at the Academy, just busting a tune out. And it was kind of hilarious and kind of awesome. And, you know, so yeah, Karen Black was a dude. She was a really amazing actress. And I've been reading a lot of amazing stories this week from people online who had met her and had encounters with her and said she was just fascinating. Now, and she, which Rob Zombie movie is she in? Is it House of a Thousand Corpses?
I forget. I think it's House of a Thousand Corpses, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, she remained active, mostly doing indies and smaller movies in recent years. But, I mean, she never stopped working. She was always doing stuff. I apparently had been fighting cancer for several years. I think did a crowdsourcing thing last year in the hopes of trying to raise money to go to Europe to get treatment. But a one-of-a-kind actress. And I think, you know... did a lot of really amazing work, and it's a pity that she's no longer with us. I hope that she you know, understood before she left how much she meant to so many people and how respected her work was. Come back to the Five and Jimmy Dean. Jimmy Dean is still one of my favorites. Still not on DVD. I mean, it should be. They keep saying it's going to be. Well, I mean, when I showed it last year with Outfest for our Downtown 30 series, Paramount sent me a Blu-ray. So they have the elements. Yes. You know, they own the rights. It exists. It's been, you know, telecinated, all that stuff that you have to do to. I mean, they have. There's a Blu-ray sitting in somebody's office so they could mass produce it and put the thing out. In the meantime, and again, I never point to this sort of thing if people can actually pay, but if. But you can see the whole movie on YouTube. So while it is currently, you know, unavailable in through more legitimate means, by all means, go to YouTube, watch, come back to the Five.
I do not have a problem with directing people to see things on YouTube if it is not available anywhere.
Right. No, absolutely.
If you can't get this movie and it's on YouTube,
yeah,
like go watch it on YouTube.
Yeah, if it's Los Angeles plays itself or something that's never going to be on DVD, or if it's something that for some reason, for some weird market or legal or whatever reason, is not currently available, yeah, by all means.
If it's being held up because someone's greedy, go watch it on YouTube.
That'll learn them.
Yeah, that's what I think. So, six. And then Edie Gourmet.
And Edie Gourmet, I mentioned. Also,
You did mention her?
Mm-hmm. I mentioned her before saying
Marlon Cain. Oh, I see. All right. Here, do me a favor.
And it turns out somebody was saying today.
I need you to stop the thing here.
Okay. Sorry, whatever is blooming right now in Southern California has Dave and me both being rather schnotty.
Well, it was that's why I wasn't talking last
Yeah, time. You were
right. And called.
Thanks again to William Bibbiani of
my doppelganger
of the Bibbiani's podcast for stepping in on your behalf.
Come over and be.
One quick thing I want to say
almost as good as me.
Well, there you go.
The mic.
One quick thing I wanted to say about Edie Gourmet that I did not know until we were having the discussion online about it in the wake of her passing. She and Steve Lawrence were in the top three of people who were on Johnny Carson more than anybody else.
Really?
Yeah.
Who else?
I don't know who the other two were.
Oh.
But they were up there. And
well, they were swell.
They were. Yeah, she was they were married for how long did you say?
55 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
In the show business.
They got married in 1957.
Wow.
Yeah.
Her first big hit was Blame It on the Bossa Nova in the 60s.
Right.
And we were just talking today about it in the during the lounge craze of the 90s, there was a compilation album out called Loungeapalooza that had sort of artists of the day doing loungy versions of songs, but also singers of yore. And Steve and Edie do a version of Soundgarden's Black Hole Sun that is great.
It's terrific. Yeah. And I just know they were added to that record as a goof.
And then
they kicked it out.
I mean,
then they showed what they could do.
I kind of feel like whoever put that album together knew what they were doing. I mean, it feels to me like it was made affectionately. You know, you've got like Glenn Campbell and Michelle Schacht doing a version of Wichita Lineman together. Piscato 5 covering The Girl from Ipanema. I'm sure you don't.
I guess it's because I was working in a record store at the time.
Oh, okay.
And people would come in to buy it, and they were like, oh, look at this terrible.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, I'm like.
Yeah, I was always unironic about the lounge craze. I still love that music. The Ben Folds 5 sort of loungy version of Flaming Lips, She Don't Use Jelly, I think is genius.
But. Well, I guess what I was really reacting to was the trend.
Well, yeah.
The lounge trend was everybody winking at everything. And
it was ironic music to listen to while you had martinis and cigars.
Meanwhile, you know, you bring all through the 80s, you could go to any record store, any thrift store, and pick up Martin Denny and Esquivel and the Three Sons and, you know, whoever else, and bring that stuff, Ima Sumac, and bring that stuff home. And it's just astoundingly cool music, which then suddenly becomes hip and trendy so that people can laugh at it. I don't understand. I'm glad that moment is over.
Sure, but I think the upside of that moment was that all of that stuff got put out on CD.
that's the good side, yes.
You know, you can package it in as much faux leopard fur and, you know, martini shakers as you want. Right. The music itself is now on CD, and it's easier to get. And I love it unironically. I think it's great.
Listeners, he's not lying. His iPod is full of that stuff.
My easy listening cup runneth over.
When we are driving around town, that's what's in the car.
All right, 6 new movies this week. We need to get rolling on it.
Why don't you start with In a World, because I didn't see it.
Okay, sure.
You can get that out of the way in 60 seconds.
Okay, so Lake Bell, actress you may know, she was in Black Rock earlier this year. She was in the not very funny Over Her Dead Body with Paul Rudd and Eva Longoria. I think she was in What Happens in Vegas. Anyway, this is her.
Have I seen any of these movies?
You saw What Happens in Vegas.
Did I?
With Ashton Kutcher and Cameron Diaz?
I don't remember.
Anyway, you know who Lake Bell is.
I do know who Lake Bell is.
So she stars in the film. She writes it. She wrote, she directed, I think she produced it, the whole McGilla. And she plays a woman who is a dialect coach, but who wants to do more voiceover work.
Right.
Her father is this guy who was considered, alongside the legendary Don LaFontaine, to be, you know, one of the deans of movie trailer voiceovers. So he's retired. He's never particularly encouraged her in that regard. And he's what's happening in the movie is that some big movie quadrilogy is coming out, and they're bringing back the legendary In a World.
Right.
And so her father is going to pass the reins on to this new guy, Gustav, who's the hot narration guy who's played by Ken Marino of Party Down. And she winds up getting, she's up for the gig because apparently there's a female heroine in the movie, and they want to try out doing a female voice for the trailer, which is unheard of, which is true. If you think about it, you almost never hear female voices narrating movie trailers.
The language of cinema is universal.
Exactly.
That's kind of it.
Right.
There are
I think like some rom-coms maybe have done it, but it's definitely the exception. So her father is so sort of aghast that she's in the running that he actually comes back out of retirement to try and get the job.
I see.
Meanwhile, she's had to move out of his house because the father's got his young girlfriend moving in. She's moving in with her married sister and her husband, and they've got issues.
How much more of this plot do I have to
There's
a lot going on.
That's my issue with this movie.
How many more things?
There's too much in the pot. As somebody pointed out, sometimes when people write a first screenplay, they worry they're never going to get to write a second one, so they basically shoehorn in every idea they ever had and every message they want to impart. And
I've seen those early Spike Lee movies where there's like a million things happening.
Totally. I mean, I remember watching this movie called Naturally Native that had played at Sundance, and we screened it in Dallas.
Right.
And it was made by a Native American female filmmaker.
I remember this now. You showed this to me.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
it was like over 2 hours long, and they had a million things happening, and sex scenes, and it didn't even have anything to do with the plot.
And issues about, you know, Native American gambling casinos, and about sports team mascots. I mean, just like you could tell everything she was dying to say was crammed into this movie.
Right.
Kind of the same thing within a world. And the thing is, there's a lot of funny stuff in this movie. The acting is really good. She has a really strong cast of comedians, but they get to do dramatic stuff, like the sister is played by Michaela Watkins and her husband is played by Rob Corddry, and they have kind of a bump in their relationship and have to do some sort of deep, you know, angsty kind of stuff, and they're really good, and
a booty bump?
They don't have a booty bump. And so, you know, basically what I've been saying is I'm dying to see Lake Bell's second movie because I think this is a really promising film, even though it's ugly, but a lot of first films are, especially writer-directors, I think, tend to gravitate more to the script than how it's shot. But, yeah, there's too much going on in this movie. I mean, it's not awful. It's just it's flawed, and I wish she had kind of trimmed it down in the script stage. But I think she's a very promising filmmaker. She's got interesting stuff to say. I've always liked her as a performer, so, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing more stuff from her. That's it.
I was recently approached about quitting, failing at voice work myself.
About quitting failing?
Yes. Up until now, I've been a failure. at it. And by failing, I mean I took a class 10 years ago where they told me I was never going to be good because I was not an actor. And then...
No, they told you that you would have to work at it really hard if you wanted to do it.
And I would have to become an actor.
And that you didn't
I would have to learn how to be an actor.
No, I understand that.
But okay, you can... You know, you can... let's go back to the horse and the oats. You can lead a horse to them oats. But no. You can't make them oats start talking. And so,
if this was the thing that you really super wanted to do and wanted to devote the time and energy to do it, you could, but you don't, so you aren't.
I'm not an actor, and I don't know that I'll ever have that that thing in me that makes me able to be one.
Sure.
So I told the person that story, and then I told about the time when I was asked. I did do a thing where I was the voice of a pitch reel. For a reality show.
That a friend of ours asked you to do.
A friend of ours asked me to do. And I was the worst thing in the world. Like, he had to feed me every line and tell me what word to emphasize. And every line I had to... Okay, here's a thing that I'm not good at.
Lying.
No, I'm a great liar.
That's true, you are, now I think about it.
Enthusiasm. Mm. I cannot... get up to that pitch of fevered excitement, especially about things that are really ridiculous. And so, unless it's something really ridiculous that I love.
Well, I was going to say, yeah. You're all over it.
I can't fake excitement. And even when I am excited, I'm not excited enough for the world of commercials. Like, it's just not in me. And so, you know, I'm telling my story to this person. And I'm saying, here's why I'm a failure, and here's why this idea cannot work. And this person said, I don't care what your stories are. Your voice is cool. Lady, like 5 feet away, total stranger, not even part of the conversation, goes, yes, your voice is very cool.
See, strangers stop you on the street.
It's, you know, probably not going to happen. And what I further explained as this process went on, and I wound up talking to the person on the card, blah blah blah. I said, you know, I think I'm delightful on this podcast that I do, and I think I sound terrific when I'm on KCRW, when I'm on Unfictional, and I'm reading my own work.
Sure.
I'm reading a story that I wrote. Then I know exactly how it's supposed to sound. I know exactly where the emotion, you know, has to go and how to sell the thing that I'm trying to sell, because I'm telling you this story.
You just can't be all, attention homeowners, is a reverse mortgage right for you?
Yeah. I mean, I'm willing to try to be the attention homeowners, is this reverse mortgage right for you guy? I won't say it'll never happen. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying there are already 3,000 other guys in Los Angeles who already know how to do this stuff.
This is true.
And so anyway, yeah, maybe you will just enjoy me on this podcast forever.
And that will have to do.
Forever.
Well, and I'm hoping that in the way that I was able to get the rights to 101 Must See Movies back from what's left of Allison Books, that you will be able to do likewise for Exile and Guy Girl.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And record the long-awaited audiobook.
That is going to happen.
Okay, good. Whenever you talk about having to emphasize certain things in a certain way for advertising, I always think of Mia Farrow in Radio Days doing the Get Regular with Relax jingle for the laxative, and how they wanted to be happier about it and emphasize the X in Relax, and
yeah.
You'll want to relax on the top of the Empire
State. I even remember when back when movies.com first hired me back in 2005,
uh-huh.
And they had that big idea they were going to put me on camera.
Right.
They filmed all these little spots.
The first of two times.
Yeah. Right? Poor Rye, who was my director, was always having to be, energy up. Energy up. Energy up. And I'm like, dude, I'm okay.
can totally picture this. Yeah, you're...
I'm good at one thing. I have one job.
You have to think to yourself, how would Ruta Lee do this?
I'm good at one thing. That's it. Plus cooking delicious treats.
That's true.
All right. Were them illers?
Would that they were.
Them were illers.
They were illin'. Oh, boy. Okay, so we're the Millers. Jason Sudeikis is a drug dealer, and he gets his stash and cash ripped off, and the only way he can make things right with his boss, drug lord Ed Helms, is to smuggle a whole bunch of weed over the border back from Mexico up to Colorado. He figures the only way he can do this, because Jason Sudeikis looks so seedy, of course, that he would immediately get pegged as a drug smuggler, is to make a fake family.
In his defense, he has messy hair.
And a hoodie.
And a hoodie.
And hasn't shaved.
At the beginning of the film.
He has to put together a fake family that he's going to load into an RV so that they can breeze through customs without getting a second look. He gets his neighbor, with whom he does not get along, and who is a stripper, played by Jennifer Aniston, runaway teen Emma Roberts, and dorky neighbor boy Will Poulter, and they head into a giant recreational vehicle and go down to Mexico, and wackiness doesn't ever really ensue much. A little bit, but not a whole lot of wackiness.
Yeah.
And certainly not a whole lot of R-rated wackiness, which this movie keeps promising, threatening, dancing around that they're going to be really naughty and outrageous, but they're not.
The end.
Boom. Also, Jennifer Aniston is a stripper who never takes her bra off.
Even in the scene where she strips down to her bra and panties and then water is poured all over her?
Yes.
After that moment, her hands are covering her boobs so that you cannot see
I didn't even notice that.
The wet bra. It's that timid and pathetic.
Mm.
A film. I wish they had just gotten, you know, another comic actor who would have been willing to just be naked.
Yeah, or even use a body double, the back occasionally. There are ways you could work around this if she doesn't want to have her headlights in the camera.
I've said this all week long. Elizabeth Berkley laughs at you.
Yeah, Demi Moore is rolling her eyes.
Yeah. You know, I get it. On the level of, first of all, I want it to be known that I don't think that the movies should be just full of boobies all the time.
No, but if you're going to be,
boobies are delightful.
If you're going to present scenarios in which boobies would normally appear, it takes
then us you better out make them it. Appear.
Yeah, because it the second that I'm in a strip club where everybody has a top.
And I'm also talking about the wangs and wieners.
Yes, absolutely. I always
make it all across the board. Everybody's got to get naked if they're going to get naked. If the story means it's time to get naked, get naked.
Yeah. If you ever saw that movie Death at a Funeral, either version, I guess. I didn't see the American remake, but I saw the original British one, where Alan Tudyk gets, you know, accidentally drugged up and winds up running around the house naked.
Yes.
He is always running behind flower pots and lamps and strategically placed items. And all I could think was, you know, if you just showed us the wang for 2 seconds, we'd be done with it.
Right.
But because you keep hiding it, all I keep thinking about is, how are they going to keep hiding Alan Tudyk's wang?
Yes, right.
And that's all that scene now means to me, is the hiding
of... Remember all the different ways
they did the same thing.
They hid the penises and everywhere.
Yeah.
I understand Jennifer Aniston's...
Reluctance.
Particular reluctance, because... Think about her for just a second.
Mm-hmm. She's already walking tabloid fodder.
Outside of Friends, what is her most memorable screen role that she really made come alive?
Friends with Money?
And The Good Girl.
And The Good Girl,
yeah. Little indie dramas where she's bummed out. All right. Movies nobody saw.
Right.
Movies everyone should see.
Right.
Friends with Money and The Good Girl. They're both terrific films, and she's terrific in them. If you don't, if you think she's not got it outside of being on Friends, go see those movies.
Yeah,
watch them. You will be surprised. But she's not known as an actor. Unfortunately, she's known as a celebrity.
Personality.
She's a part of celebrity culture. She's not really part of film history in the way we think of that.
True.
And so her situation is weird in that whatever she does becomes news.
Right.
And if she takes off her top in a movie, that's going to be Halle Berry level crazy.
But then,
Halle Berry did it and won an Oscar. After that. And so,
but why play a stripper?
I understand.
At all.
I was about to say, she should not have been cast as this person.
No. And yeah, I have no great desire to see boobs. I just don't want to be taken out of the movie by not boobs, you know.
I want to see everything. All the boobs, all the vaginas. All the penises.
Be like in France.
I want to see all the balls. All the butt cheeks.
Yeah. No.
Everything. I want to see everything.
Again, this was a country founded by all the people who got kicked out of Europe for being too boring.
Yeah.
And it resonates.
Let's not be boring anymore.
It resonates to this day.
Everyone,
knock it off.
More anyway. Flesh.
Yes.
Everywhere.
Yes.
The supermarket. The bank.
Church.
Churches. Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles.
Yeah, especially there.
Yeah. This movie has a laugh every 6 to 8 minutes.
Yeah. The funniest stuff is the outtakes that they show over the closing credits.
And whenever anybody who's a character actor is clearly improvising.
Yeah. Yeah. This is...
You know my favorite thing in this movie is?
They can't go off book enough in this film.
The carny? The kid who plays the carny is... terrific, and I'm blanking on his name right now. His character's name is like Scotty P or something like that. He's really funny, and during the outtakes over the end, you see how quickly he works because
it's like watching the outtakes of Bridesmaids, where Wendy McClendon Covey is just
popping them off. You know, these alternate takes. They just turned a camera on this kid and said, okay, go, just say crazy things.
Mark L. Young.
Yeah, Mark L. Young, the best thing about We're the Millers. I don't know you at all, Mark L. Young.
Funny.
He's been in a bunch of stuff.
Ken Marino is in this movie, too.
Yeah.
Oh, one thing I wanted to mention about We're the Millers, about In a World, rather, that was interesting, just from the point of view of it being a female director. She shows Ken Marino's body a lot.
Yeah.
And clearly he's been working out. You know, he does that web series that's sort of like a Bachelor parody where he's a fireman. Have you seen this?
Yes.
And so he's clearly been going to the gym. And so he is in his underwear. He's taking steam baths. It's just like, okay, sure. Why not?
Right.
Why not?
She's directing her gaze at him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so do we have to keep talking about Where the Millers?
No, I don't think we do.
It is a forgettable, unfunny comedy where occasionally things happen that will make you laugh, and then you'll forget what it was you laughed at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Elysium.
Elysium stars Matt Damon and Jodie Foster and
Charlotte. I interviewed him once.
Carlito's Way.
I think it's Shoto Copley, but I'm not entirely sure. And Alice Braga, who I am growing convinced is kind of a bad luck charm for films.
I thought she was fine in this movie.
She's never particularly bad. She just always, every time she's in a movie, it winds up being lesser than you think it was going to be.
What just happened?
Again with the shade, and knocked over this lamp, which luckily did not break.
Wow. This is now two times on this show that the shade has opened because of the wind and something has come crashing.
You'd think we would have learned after the first time. But
a pretty expensive lamp just fell off a shelf.
And did not break.
And did not break.
Even though it is porcelain at its base. You need to stop putting things on that shelf.
I'm going
to
do that. No more things on that shelf ever again.
Tell to the mirror, because I don't put things there. You do it.
What were we talking about?
Alice Brock.
Elysium.
Elysium, yes. So, okay, so it's Neil Blomkamp's second film.
Another dystopian future.
Yes, it's follow-up to District 9, and yes, once again, we've made the Earth a mess.
Here's what I do appreciate. We haven't made the world a mess.
The ruling elites have made
the world. Ruling elite, greedy, rich people and their corporations have destroyed everything.
Polluted everything.
And then absconded with what was left.
Right.
Up to the moon.
To an orbiting satellite called Elysium.
So the Jetsons future, where we're all going to live in space with robot helpers.
Yeah.
Is all the rich people are going to live in space with robot helpers.
The 0.001% will pull that off.
The rest of y'all are going to be dirt people.
Are stuck in Mad Max.
Forever. Yeah. With no medicine.
Building the robots.
No food.
To go up to Elysium to clean up.
The robots that you get to have on Earth.
Are cops.
Are cops and parole officers who are like seventh generation robots that barely function. And
they kind of reminded me of the ones in Idiocracy.
Yeah.
Like when he's talking to his parole officer that's basically sort of a mannequin with a speech box. I was reminded So it's awful, awful future, and Matt Damon is an ex-con who's trying to get his life together. Excuse me. And he works in a robot factory, gets a lethal dose of radiation, has 5 days to live, and so decides, all right, the heck with it. I'm going to Elysium because that's the only place where they have these metapods or something.
It's like a tanning bed.
That fixes you. Remember the thing that Noomi Rapace climbs into in Prometheus to get the alien cut out of her body?
Yes.
It's kind of like that, only instead of lasers, it just rearranges your molecules and takes away your leukemia or whatever.
Fixes everything.
Yeah. So, of course, only the rich people have them, so he wants to go up there. And then it winds up being this caper movie where he basically, it's pick up on South Street or whatever, the movie where somebody steals what they think is just a briefcase, and it turns out it's a briefcase that has the atomic codes in them, and so everybody wants the... Right. So he's being chased for the stuff that he has in his brain that he stole out of the brain of William Fichtner.
Yeah.
Jodie Foster struts around in power suits with an indecipherable, weird accent.
We will get to that in a moment.
Barking commands. And
we disagree about this particular aspect of the film.
I like it as sort of a sci-fi action movie. I like how in both films, Blomkamp can take the technology of the future and turn it into sort of kind of grungy and work a day while at the same time being all advanced. But as with District 9, which was a movie about
apartheid.
Right. This is a movie about immigration and healthcare.
Right.
With big capital letters and stuff. I think Jodie Foster gives one of the very worst performances of her career. I found myself giggling at it way more than I should have.
I found myself giggling at it too. In delight.
So you think it was intentional
on
her and Blomkamp's part?
She decided that she wanted to be a cartoon villain. And so they put her in this Susie Orman outfit and give her the hair.
Mm-hmm.
And she starts the movie speaking French with that flawless, impeccable French.
Snooty, lycée accent.
The kind that makes Kristin Scott Thomas cry.
Kristin Scott Thomas speaks much better French than Jodie Foster does.
Oh, no.
Jodie Foster speaks snooty, educated French, and Kristin Scott Thomas speaks I live here French.
Okay.
At least as far as my ear can tell.
All right. But then after she stops speaking French and starts speaking English.
In quotes.
It sounds like
After Earth.
It sounds like After Earth mixed with some kind of South African dialect, Afrikaners.
That was After Earth, too, and the South African thing. Which, Blomkamp is South African, so I suspect that's part of where that's coming from.
So she's doing this crazy accent, and doing nothing but being mean.
She's a martinet in this movie.
And I thought it was great.
I thought it was painful to watch. Even if it was intentional, it comes off ridiculous. For me, anyway.
All right, fine. I think this is a pretty standard issue action movie. You know, one brave man must save the system, the world. Which is kind of weird when you think about it, because
in a time
you've got a situation that calls for a collective response. You know, you've got capitalism extended to its nastiest, most horrible, destructive ends.
Right.
You know, we're
feudalism.
We're capitalism and just naked greed and horribleness are equated.
Right.
Anything you do opposite that is inherently somewhat socialist.
Mm-hmm.
But only as socialist as, you know, a lot of the regular sort of programs for social welfare that take place all the time.
Right.
In every country, including this country.
Which, fire departments and libraries.
Yeah, which is, you know, this country ridiculously prides itself on being, you know, so anti-socialist all the time. We're just not. So I found it kind of weird that this whole top-down approach to fixing the situation, like one brave man who hasn't been beaten down has to go fix the whole thing.
I think because in real life, as it were, I mean, yeah, it's more a question of having Occupy Elysium or whatever. And right. I think action movies generally, I mean, unless it's the A-Team or the Dirty Dozen or the Great Escape, as you pointed out in your review on movies.com.
That's right.
You know, they tend to operate more in the lone wolf model. But you're right. Yeah. This is more. And I mean, he does,
always a little kind of.
He does rely on other people to bring all this
exasperated
off,
by the lone wolf.
But it is mostly lone wolf.
The lone wolf has begun to bore me just a little bit.
Mm.
You know, unless you're really a wizard of a lone wolf.
Right.
It's not everything I want to see anymore.
I prefer the Ocean's 11 model of.
Having said that, I appreciate this movie's approach to having a point.
No, it is about something. I think it's about something obstreperously. You know, it hammers you over the head with it, but better than nothing, admittedly.
Right.
It's like with in a world, I feel bad knocking a movie for having too many ideas when so many don't have any or too few, but, you know.
Overall, I enjoyed it. I thought Jodie Foster was hilarious in a way that I was happy about.
Right. I gave it a fresh on Rotten Tomatoes.
Matt Damon makes a good lone wolf.
Sure.
He humanizes things in a way that a lot of the lone wolves don't.
True.
You're down for Matt Damon. You care about what's going on.
He has created an interesting niche for himself, I think, as an action hero, going back at least as far as the Bourne movies, where he is seemingly indestructible and yet human and vulnerable at the same time.
Right.
You know, even when in this movie, when they kind of make him part cyborg, he still feels like this
rad exoskeleton.
Uh-huh, and the TV screen on his head and all. Right. But you still feel like he feels pain, which a lot of action heroes don't bother to do.
So, you know, this is fine.
I think people were expecting it entertaining.
It doesn't pack the punch of District 9 because it doesn't come out of nowhere.
Right. And, you know, that movie, part of what was cool, I mean, I have mixed feelings about it, but part of what was cool about it was that it was kind of a low-budget movie that was sort of made outside of, you know, the normal Hollywood channels, and whereas this is his sort of big studio debut, big budget, and obviously the demands, you know, the expectations are higher, and it's not that big a leap forward for him as a filmmaker, I don't think.
No, not at all.
But yeah, it's worth seeing. Absolutely worth seeing.
Yeah. All right.
Planes. Or Percy Jackson.
Perlaine.
Perlaine's fine.
Perlaine's.
It's World of Cars. It's a spin-off of the Cars movies from Disney, not Pixar.
Sure.
And it's about a plane with a dream.
You know what I'm upset about? What's no, that? you talk, and then I'll tell you what
else. It's a plane with a dream. It's a dusty crop opera, and he's a crop duster. And incidentally, for all the lazy critics out there who were saying, why are they crop dusting crops and everything in this world is a machine?
You need to say that, like, with a real voice, because it was garbled and barely intelligible what you just said.
For all the film critics who ask, why are they growing crops on this world where everybody's a machine? Who is eating them? There is a line of dialogue where they talk about soy-based fuels and corn-based fuels. So they're growing crops that turn into gasoline for the planes and the cars.
Admittedly, it is a throwaway line.
Still.
Yeah.
I was paying attention. I caught it.
You're a good payer attention.
In a Disney cartoon.
Yeah.
The planes and the boats and trains took you away from me. Dusty wants to race.
Thanks.
Dusty wants to race around the world. He has a dream. His friends help him.
You know, I really think that you should sing in a more punk rock style. Perhaps with a safety pin in your nose.
Aren't you hilarious? He gets into the big race with all the other planes who, of course, at first don't take him seriously because he is a humble crop duster. But right. Dusty has heart and spunk and all that stuff. And
he,
you know, saves the life of the snooty British plane that is voiced by John Cleese. And he helps the Mexican luchador plane win the heart of the French-Canadian plane.
Yep, he does that too.
Anyway, I find myself in the weird position of defending this movie.
You should stop doing that.
Not because I thought it was great, but because I thought it was perfectly adequate and charming, and I had a good time with it.
It's adequate.
And I had a better time at Planes than I did at most of the other animated films this summer. I had a better time watching that than I did watching Despicable Me 2 or Monsters University. I did.
No, I did. And I'm not a huge defender of Monsters University. But this is a direct-to-DVD movie that's just happens to be big in front of you.
Look, yes, I know it was originally intended to be direct-to-DVD, but again, I don't care about these sort of backstage machinations.
That's not a backstage machination. That's on the screen. That's what you're looking at. You're looking at the B-Team production.
Granted, yes.
Of Cars.
But I'll tell you, but it's better than either of the Cars movies, even if it is less intricately animated. Story-wise and character-wise, I think it's much better.
No. And again, not a big fan of the Cars movies either. This is not as good as Cars movies.
This is not as good as Cars 2?
No.
Really?
Really.
Explain yourself.
No. I barely remember Cars 2.
There's spies and biofuels.
Yeah, spies.
And lots more Larry the Cable Guy.
Yeah.
That's why I like this one better. I would rather have Dane Cook as a crop duster than Larry the Cable Guy as a tow truck.
See, that's another reason you're wrong.
This is a weird would you rather, but there
he's an adorable pickup truck, that Larry the Cable Guy. He's sweet. He's kind-hearted.
So is Dane Cook.
Uh-huh, and boring.
Yeah,
I disagree. Real boring.
I disagree. Again, I didn't love this movie. I don't want to oversell
Planes. That's because there's nothing much to love about it.
I just liked it.
I'm getting mostly annoyed at the way that this recent rash of Disney films is it's going to harm my status with Disney publicists. They were on a roll for a while with stuff that I was really digging, and then lately it's just been like, and you know what? You know what happens when you start writing bad reviews of these films?
What?
They stop calling you their bro.
You can't get too close to the.
They're not super nice to you anymore. Well, they were being super nice to me, and now it's. It's, you know, not as warm as it used to be.
Look, I went out on a limb.
I'm not going to change my ways.
I went out on a limb and defended Meet the Robinsons, which is a movie that a lot of people have decided they just hate.
That needs a reevaluation.
That's an amazing movie.
Meet the Robinsons needs a reevaluation.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I've noticed lately that the early invites and the
like, well, if that's the case, they should love me because I'm one of the few positive reviews. Bibbs and I are two of a very few people that liked playing.
I'll make sure they know.
So say you're Mrs. Guy Who Liked Planes.
Yeah. No, everything is fine between me and the Disney publicists, but I've been like, oh, I don't like that Disney movie or that one or that one or this other one or that one they did before, and so I'm realizing that about how it's going, yeah. So and that's you cannot let that affect you.
No. I'm glad that I work for the kind of website where when Universal voiced their displeasure at my review of Les Mis, my bosses at the rap were like, well, too bad. They rather enjoyed the fact that I was causing
agita. I have the full support.
Yes, I know.
No one has ever... at movies.com, no one has ever said, could you be nice to this?
Or, yeah, no.
We got
please, you were pooping on Disney movies when Disney owned movies.com. I still remember your Chicken Little review.
Yeah, it was one of my first ones.
Yeah.
And it was sort of like, oh good, right out of the box.
Hello, new boss.
So... please make more Winnie the Pooh films, is really what I'm trying to say.
That would be lovely.
If you could make a new Winnie the Pooh movie every year and have it to be the quality
of that last one,
then you'll have me in your pocket for pretty much ever the rest of my life. Please do not make Planes, Fire, and Rescue, which is the name of the
Too
new.
Late.
I know.
And apparently, Boats and Trains are next.
I like a good train, you know.
How are they going to make
remember
it not
when
look
we
like
rode
Thomas?
On that train from Paris to Madrid?
Oh, that was great.
That was great.
How are they going to make
trains are cool?
How are they going to make trains not like Thomas the Tank Engine? Edward Gordon.
I don't know, but it's a good thing that your nephew is no longer 3 years old and easily terrified by Thomas the Tank Engine.
Well, he adored Thomas the Tank Engine.
Until the movie took him to the movie. Yeah,
scared the crap out of him.
Alec Baldwin. It's his fault.
There you go.
That mean Alec Baldwin.
Yes, my 3-year-old nephew's like, oh, is that the guy who called his daughter a little pig? Get me out of here.
All right.
Percy Jackson. : Sea of Monsters.
Yes.
I was kind of charmed by this.
Yeah, everyone hates this movie except you and me.
Yeah, it's very much treading in the Harry Potter waters, and it is, you know, kind of a minor thing, but I like how completely unironic it is. There's a little bit of jokiness about, you know, where the gods are sort of hiding in plain sight.
You know? I will tell you what happens in this movie.
Do.
He has to get the golden fleece.
Right.
So that he can fix a barrier, a supernatural barrier that's separating the demigod training camp from all the bad people that want to kill the demigods.
Right.
So him and all the other American Apparel model teenagers are the demigods. And did I say him and all the? I did say him, didn't I?
Yeah.
So he's got to go get the golden fleece.
Yeah, and he has a new half-brother who is a Cyclops.
A Cyclops.
Who is played by the son from Big Love.
Oh, that's who that is?
Yeah.
Okay.
You didn't recognize him with the one eye in the middle of his
head. I barely watched Big Love.
Oh.
I only ever watched Chloe Sevigny doing crazy things on Big Love. No, you get it wrong.
Sorry, Dave's favorite moment where
my very favorite moment.
She's got a mouthful of waffles.
Chloe Sevigny has a mouthful of waffles, and she looks at Jennifer Goodwin, who's dressed in an incredibly modest, I'm going to my bank teller job outfit. And Chloe Sevigny, with a mouthful of waffles, says, You look like a complete whore. It's the best.
That show was really terrific. You should have watched more of it.
So, so there's, you know, there's kid level action, and it has the feeling of a story told by a kid.
And then
nothing seems to organically flow, and anything else is like, well, we were being chased on a boat, and now we're at an amusement park, and here comes the, you know,
Chiron.
Here comes the
Kronos.
So there's nothing. Not one sequence has any more excitement than any other sequence in the film. All these set pieces feel approximately the same.
Mm-hmm.
And the ending, obviously, is already mapped out. You know, he's going to get the Golden Fleece.
Spoiler.
Or else everything is going to be destroyed.
Right, yeah. Or existence will come to
or
an
he
end.
Dies.
Hmm, yeah. And so, how is this going to play out?
So in order for there to be a part three,
which there will be,
they have to get the Golden Fleece. So of course they get the Golden Fleece.
Naturally. And there's a cool, like, this oracle who you never see, but you just hear her voice.
Yeah.
And it's Shorey Agdashlu.
Your pal, Shorey
Agdashlu. She's so good at it, this exact kind of thing. Yep. I mean, like, it just it's you know, she's basically the new Irene Pappas, you know. she's the sort of scary, you know, Mediterranean woman. Yep. With the voice and the thing, and
right.
I love
she
her.
Has a terrific voice.
She's great. So yeah, it's a fun movie. It's a fun kind of goofy. It's like I compared it to the movies that Ray Harryhausen used to animate, and obviously now it's all CG, but those sort of Sinbad, Hercules kind of 1950s movies where they're charming and silly and entertaining and ultimately disposable.
Well,
that's this.
I saw it on opening morning because I missed the press screenings. And I'd say it's about a third full at the Grove, and the kids there were really, really excited. These were
book
the,
fans.
The super fan kids, uh-huh. You know, who all went woohoo when it started, and they applauded when it was over. Those kids are down. Those kids are into this, and I assume that there were enough of them to make a sequel, and I assume there are going to be enough of them to make another one.
Yeah, this one didn't open quite as big. I had no idea that the first one did well enough to merit a sequel, but
I didn't either.
And, Christopher Columbus is not directing this time. It's Thor Freudenthal, who did Hotel for Dogs and Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
Neither of which are terrible kid movies.
No, not at
all.
He
has kind of a good feel for a style of children's film that doesn't have nasty attitudes in it.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, as I said in my review on The Wrap, we're in an era where even The Smurfs 2 has to sort of arch an eyebrow and mock its own existence.
Right.
And these movies are, they don't have time for that. And they don't have happening pop culture references. I mean, yes, they look up the information on about the Golden Fleece on an iPad or whatever. But
these are movies for kids.
This absolutely.
This is a kid movie.
But it's a good one.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. Because there's plenty that are crap.
Right.
Which leaves us with my favorite movie this week, or opening this week, David Gordon Green's Prince Avalanche.
It is also my favorite.
Nice.
This week. Yeah.
Opening limited release. I think it might be available on demand as well. I'm not sure.
And it's about two guys, Paul Rudd and Emil Hirsch. It's the late 80s, 87, 88.
Something like that.
They are road workers in rural Texas.
Yeah.
After a really awful wildfire that has destroyed everything for miles and miles and miles and miles. And their job is to paint the stripe in the middle of the rebuilt road. And to put up reflective sign, reflective posts. And that's what they're supposed to do all summer long. And there's no internet, so they are not connected to the world in any way. They are only connected to each other. And they have to camp out at night, and they have to work side by side doing this job all day. And that's the movie.
Yeah.
Like, that's just them talking.
Getting on each other's nerves.
Getting on each other's nerves, running into people, an old man who gives them booze, they get drunk, they screw around, they go swimming, they
run to a mysterious old lady who's kind of digging through the charred remains of her own house.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a remake of an Icelandic film, although apparently they don't have a whole lot in common. I think David Gordon Green told Chrissy Lemire when she interviewed him that he was mainly just sort of interested in the idea of these characters against this sort of bleak backdrop. Yeah. So yeah, they went out and shot it in Bastrop, which is outside of Austin, and for no money and a skeleton crew, and just kind of throwing it together. And I think it's great, and it may be one of his best films because it really is. It marries the two sort of strains of his career to date. You know, you have your George Washington undertow kind of Terrence Malick.
All the real girls.
All the real girls, you know, sort of long stretches of quiet and the majesty of nature and you know, characters stuck in locations. And then you have the sort of more outrageous bro comedies like Pineapple Express and Your Highness. And this movie kind of incorporates both of those things and mixes them in a really interesting way and kind of reveals that they've both sort of been in all of his movies all along in one way or another.
Those early films had weird comic touches that you weren't used to seeing in beautiful indie films.
Right.
Danny McBride's very first role in a feature film is in All the Real Girls.
Well, Danny McBride,
Jody Hill. He plays a character called Bust Ass.
Danny McBride, Jody Hill, and David Gordon Green all went to film school together in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And so they've, you know. And apparently David Gordon Green's undergrad stuff was all very comedic and bizarre. And so when he busted out George Washington, people were surprised. People that knew his work up till then were surprised because it was so different.
Yeah. And as I said in my review on movies.com, if you go look at Pineapple Express, there is thematically, you see a lot of the same stuff that you see in a film like This Is the End. You've got guys together doing something outlandish, but who have this, if you're paying attention to the movie, you have this great need for intimacy among these guys. And it's mostly on the part of Franco, who is clearly in love with Rogan's character in Pineapple Express.
Right.
And that is extended into This Is the End.
Yeah, like they do it again
in This Is the End. But that's not, you know, just James Franco being crazy. I mean, that's in the script.
Yeah.
And so you have, and Prince Avalanche is not a film where one of the men is in love with one of the others. That's not that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the need for connection among these guys who are being, you know, adolescently stupid with one another.
Right, and who don't really understand the mechanics of intimacy, but clearly
on any level, and that's one of the reasons they're having problems with their ladies back home.
Right, but they clearly have a need to connect both, not just with women, but with each other in a platonic way.
If I have any beef with this movie, it's that connectivity feels a little rushed to me at the end. Like, suddenly, they're very affectionate with one another.
I think it's earned. I think things happen in the story that sort of maybe push in a way that felt organic to me.
Right. But if you're going to be set in a very real world, then I would like very real behavior. The end of the summer doesn't mean people automatically have emotional epiphanies.
No, I don't
becoming close to one another.
I wasn't talking about the end of the summer. There's plot stuff that I don't want to reveal here, but I think those things that happen cause, I don't know. I've seen it twice now. It felt natural.
The thing with the lady, the return of the lady.
I think she could have appeared once, and that would have been great.
Right.
But you know, I didn't mind it.
But in general, I think it's really good.
Yeah.
And look for this one. It is not playing in a theater near you, but you can find it somewhere. Is it on demand? You said you thought it was.
It might be. I'll look.
Well, if it is, you'll put it on the site. You'll put it on the page.
Absolutely. Yeah. Is that everything?
That is everything.
All right. So, contest time.
Why don't you talk about the winner and read their entry. So there were a lot of entries.
Yes, we got...
We were really tempted to be mercenary about
just,
it.
Just to remind people, this was our giveaway of the smaller-sized Annabelle doll from The Conjuring that we were sent by the fine people at Warner Brothers.
It's smaller than the one in the movie, but it's still about a foot tall.
Yeah, no. It's not tiny. It's just not, you know, sort of child-sized the way the one in the film is.
Right.
No less creepy, however.
Yeah, it's gross.
So we want this thing out of our house. It's disturbing.
We had a lot of entries.
We did.
Which is surprising to me. Every time I think that we don't have anyone listening to us, we have people listening to us, like, in the Netherlands. I just found that out.
Israel and Australia. It's crazy. Right. Several people left their entries as comments on the photo on Facebook,
which was
against the rules. I very specifically said, email your entries to linoleumcast@gmail.com. So only the entries received at linoleumcast@gmail.com even considered by our panel of judges.
And we were very tempted to be completely mercenary and give it to the person that promised us plugs on his blog and his own podcast.
Yes.
What was his name? Ted?
John.
John. Not Tim or Ted,
Tim
but John.
Ted John, yes.
John, we're sorry. Right. Your entry was great.
We appreciate your attempt to grease the wheels there.
And I appreciate also...
Cross our palm
I appreciate silver. How many times he saw the movie.
True.
He's four, like
four times opening weekend.
Yeah. And his enthusiasm and commitment to cinema.
Yes.
But you did not win the doll.
No, sorry. Our winner is...
You were the first runner-up, though.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No question. Our winner is Josh Yeager, who sent us...
Read it.
Sort of the Edgar Allan Poe entry.
Read it.
His title is, My Long Lost Love. And Josh writes, I wallow in melancholia since my love departed this plane. Our romance was forbidden. One sweet summer's night, we snuck out for a kiss by the old well. We rushed to embrace in the murky moonlight. I lost my footing and knocked my sweet to her death. Please reunite us. You win, Josh. That was our best entry.
Yep.
So you are the lucky winner of this creepy and hideous Annabelle doll.
So we will
we'll be contacting you at your email address to find out how to send it to you and how to get it out of this house.
Yeah,
once it's gone, we have to burn a smudge stick or something because it's just good.
We're about to get possessed.
No kidding.
All right, here are lots of letters.
All right.
Some of these are new letters. Some of these are letters from people who sent these letters a long time ago, and we somehow, and by we I mean
you.
We lost them.
Thanks to everyone who busted us on that and resent their letters that Dave lost.
All right, here we go.
Dave, my one job, and I can't even do it.
I'm fixing to read a whole bunch of letters here.
Go.
Hey, Dave and Alonzo. Big fan of the podcast. I've been listening for over a year now.
Woo.
I don't normally watch many summer action movies, especially the superhero ones, but my brother and I saw Pacific Rim last weekend. I noticed something that was prevalent in The Dark Knight, and I suspect in many other contemporary summer blockbusters. What is with the constant soundtrack throughout the movie, even under ordinary dialogue? I find it very distracting, and it makes the movie seem like either one long montage or a musical. Is this a modern trend that I've missed, or was it always the case in older action movies, or at least ones from the 90s during my childhood? Thanks, Jeremy. He's right about this.
Yeah, I think there's a fear of silence.
There is almost... Here's why I know this, just from my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
Very often, someone is misbehaving in a movie theater, and I need to make them behave. However...
Oh, you always want to wait for the quiet.
When I'm trying to wait for the quiet moment to tell them to knock it off and behave themselves... Sometimes that quiet moment never comes.
Mm.
And I believe it's one reason why people really feel justified in having normal-voiced conversations in the middle of films, taking phone calls, because unless you're sitting very close to them, you might not even hear that they hear that happening.
Right.
Because these movies are now so loud and so full of noise and sound,
mm-hmm.
there is almost no silence left. in films.
Unless it's a very intentional, like quiet, a horror movie. Film, sort of, yeah. Like, nah, 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 yeah. You know. You're right. No, it's true. And I don't know what to trace it back to or where it started, but it's definitely a thing that's happening.
Stupidity.
Now.
You can trace it back to
stupidity. I don't mean that. I mean in terms of, I mean chronologically.
Right.
Like how long has this been going on? I don't know.
Yeah. Like you could, in some of these movies, you could have a vuvuzela and just start honking it. And nobody would notice. Like, that's how loud some of these are. I'm going to experiment with that.
You're going to bring a vuvuzela?
I'm going to bring a vuvuzela to a press screening of some loud, noisy
there you go.
Summer tentpole movie and just start honk, honk. See who notices.
Why not?
Hi, gents. Thanks for reading and responding to my Only God Forgives letter in such detail last
week. This is the guy with the girlfriend?
Yeah. Just wanted to say I'm 99% sure I did not sign the last email properly, so Alonzo, please don't persecute Dave for my error.
Don't take his side.
He, meaning Dave, mm-hmm. went to the trouble to find my name on previous emails to the show.
Look, nobody asked
Emphasis
you...
Emphasis mine.
Nobody asked you to get in the middle here. I'll thank you to butt out.
I'm still reading his letter. My best friend's letter mm-hmm. here. Dave, it's an honor to be declared your bro. It is. It totally super is.
Once you finally figure out how to read a letter.
I got your back. I'd devise a crude refrigerator bomb to save either you or Alonzo from an Indonesian machete fight. Rock on. Dan. Thank you, Dan.
Look, Dan.
We're tight bros forever, Dan.
Stay out of it, Dan.
I'll share my vuvuzela with you.
Nobody asked you, Dan.
Next one. Hi, guys. First off, thanks so much for the podcast. I do data entry all day. And listening to you two really helps me get through. I'm catching up on old episodes.
4, 6, 2, 9.
So far.
Sorry, I'm trying to throw him off what? The data entry.
You're a bad human being. You suck.
Just wanted to know that we're paying
all right,
attention
we're gonna, to. You know what we're going to do? We're going to observe a little moment of silence right now so that our friend, the listener who wrote this letter, can reorient him and or herself to the job that he or she is doing.
Okay. I think he or she is. Okay. He or she is caught up now.
You think so.
Just hit delete a few times. They're fine.
Hi, guys. First off, thanks so much for the podcast.
I can't believe you're starting over.
I do data entry all day, and listening to YouTube really helps get me through. I'm catching up on old episodes, and so far I'm current for 2013, and I'm up to August 2011.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have we been on that long?
We've been on forever.
Whoa.
We wrote the very first song.
That's true. Yeah, we started in late 2010, now that I think about it.
My top 10 list is below. These aren't the best films I've ever seen, but they are movies that I get something new out of every time I watch them. La Dolce Vita. Sorry, Alonzo, in parentheses. The Shining.
Sure.
Cabaret.
Yeah.
Silence of the Lambs.
Okay.
Drive.
Mm.
The Godfather.
Yep.
Uncle Buck. Uncle Buck is terrific.
Uncle Buck.
You know Uncle Buck is good.
Uncle Buck is the movie that broke me of going to see John Hughes movies on opening day. I went because...
Uncle Buck is swell.
I went to all the good ones, and then, you know, I got through The Great Outdoors and all these others. And then Uncle Buck was like, okay, John Hughes.
Are you done talking?
We're not.
Can we get back to this
we're
person's
done now.
Letter full of good movies?
Go on.
Spirited Away.
Great.
The Passion of Joan of Arc.
Nice.
Yeah. Jackie Brown.
Okay.
True Romance.
All right.
That's 100% knife.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
It can't be 100% knife because my vote counts, and so... I will even allow for La Dolce Vita because I understand that's my thing and it didn't work
that's
for me, but people
thing,
love
yeah.
that movie. You're the dumb. You're, right, well, you're my dumb thing.
You.
But I'm not giving Uncle Buck.
All right, so well, you're 95%.
95%
knife. That's still an A.
Fine.
It's a solid A. It's not even an A minus. honorable mentions. This Is Not a Film.
Mm.
Winter's Bone.
Mm-hmm.
Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Absolutely.
And Akira.
Yeah.
Also, Alonzo, I know you sometimes mention you're a bit of a comics nerd. A bit. Are you currently?
I am light compared to the real ones out there, believe me. You have no idea. Go on.
Are you reading anything currently?
I'm not, because, well, okay, now I take that back. I am reading the Kevin Keller series from Archie, because I still find the notion that there is a gay teenager in Riverdale to be just flabbergasting.
All right.
But no, for the most part, I have neither the time nor the money to be keeping up with comics, and DC started everything over again. I just found out today...
Yeah.
That there was going to be this thing called Justice League 3000.
Yes.
It was going to be sort of like doing a future Justice League treatment on the Legion of Superheroes.
Okay.
And it was going to be done by Giffen, DeMatteis, and Kevin Maguire, who did the great Justice League series in the 80s that I love so much.
Yes.
And I only found out about this existing because apparently they're scrapping it.
Oh, all right.
Kevin Maguire apparently tweeted that he got canned and that they're starting the whole thing over from scratch. And so a comic series that I didn't know was going to exist would have been one that I would have loved to have read, but is now not going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen. All right. She says, I've gotten back into comics and I'm really enjoying Young Avengers.
Okay.
And pretty much all of the currently running X-Men.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah. And that is from, thanks again, guys, Laura in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, Canada.
Hi, Alonzo and Dave. I've been listening. Whoa. I just went all crazy here. One moment, please. I've been listening to your podcast for almost a year now, and I really enjoy it. It's nice that you review not only American movies, but also have attention for foreign ones. I found your podcast through Alonzo's book, 101 Must-See Movies for Gay Men. And wanted to find out what else he had done. And now I have finished Dave's book.
Woo!
It's time for the knifing. Here is my top 10 in no particular order. Sunset Boulevard.
Great.
Dangerous Liaisons.
Okay.
He writes, the book is brilliant.
Yeah. It's a great story. I think it's... I have some
I like Dangerous Liaisons, so, you know. Weekend.
Which one?
The one that...
Andrew Haig or Godard?
Andrew Haig.
Oh, great.
Okay. Yeah. Rear Window.
Great.
Born Yesterday.
Not my favorite, but God. You know.
You and Judy Holliday, you have a problem.
I got no beef with Judy Holliday. I love her in Adam's Rib. I like her in Bells Are Ringing. I just don't think... I even like her in Born Yesterday. I just don't think it's very well written. Have you seen it?
Yes. Orlando.
Great.
The Apartment.
Great.
A 2009 film called Broderskab. I don't know what that is. So you'll have to look that up.
Broderskab?
Uh-huh. He says it's a bit harrowing.
Oh, that's right up your alley then.
Another 2009 movie called Das Weiße Band. I don't know that one either. And The Children's Hour.
Yeah, okay.
Now he's got, okay, so we're going to give you the benefit of the doubt on these.
Broderskab is called Brotherhood. And it stars Thora Lindhart.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Never heard of it. We'll check it out.
You get the benefit of the doubt on the two that we haven't seen, so you're 100%.
Yeah.
It's 100% of the knife.
I will give you Born Yesterday. Yeah. I don't, I'm not a fan.
He's got Guilty Pleasures. We're gonna read his Guilty Pleasures.
Okay, sure.
Three, you're a big fan of.
Oh, the Tom Teague version?
Yeah.
I love that movie.
Yeah. Connie and Carla.
Ooh.
For...
Oh, you know, it's weird. Connie and Carla...
Connie and Carla stars your bro...
I know.
Nia Bardalis.
And Alec Mappa. And it's funny. I think it's a movie that actually plays better with commercials. I don't know why.
The musical numbers are funny.
The musical numbers are funny, and I love any movie where there's a cameo by Debbie Reynolds, and the drag queen says to her, I loved you, and what's the matter with Helen?
For A Good Time Call.
Oh, yes.
Which we both really enjoyed last year. Victor Victoria.
Love it.
Easy A.
It's okay.
A movie with Cam Gigandet, which isn't terrible at all.
It's true. It's his one.
Not to his credit, of course.
It is his one that is not awful.
Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Sure.
Some Like It Hot.
Great.
Eight Women.
Love it.
Muriel's Wedding.
Sure.
Julie and Julia.
Yeah.
Now, if you hadn't already told us that you got to this podcast by reading 101 Must-See Movies for Gay Men, we would be able to tell right away that you are gay.
Quite a few movies on both those lists are in that book. So if I steered you towards any of them, I'm thrilled. And if you already read them on your own and just knew that meant that we had overlapping tastes, that's cool too.
Greetings from the Netherlands, Frederick.
This is the same letter.
This is the same letter that I said. Surprising.
Well, thank you, Frederick.
Listeners in the Netherlands, which is pretty swell. Is that the last one?
The Netherlands is where the city council put up all the rainbow flags because Putin was coming to town.
Oh, nice. Way to be, Netherlands.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is my brief list of some movies that I was exposed to constantly as a latchkey kid in the 80s and raised by cable television. I was wondering what your thoughts were on these titles. Four Friends.
Oh, I've never seen that one. It's a Peter Yates film, right?
It says this was on constantly. I bought it at the apex of I thought it was the apex of drama and real acting when I was 11. Bought it from a bargain bin recently and haven't had the guts to watch it. I'm afraid there will be too many cringe-inducing moments of overwrought scenery chewing that will make me embarrassed for my 11-year-old taste.
Craig Wasson is in it. It's about like these four guys with me. At least some of them, if not all of them, wind up going to Vietnam and they're all in love with the same woman. I've never seen it.
Coal Miner's Daughter.
Oh, great.
This seemed to be on every afternoon. So, yeah.
You could do worse.
Space Hunter, Adventures in the Forbidden Zone. Molly Ringwald in 3D, rubber-faced creatures adventure to save three chicks in Silver Lame from a Michael Ironside monster jammed into his twisted contraption and presiding over a Thunderdome-y maze. Winning.
Did you see it in 3D?
Did I see it in 3D? I haven't seen it.
Oh, you've never seen it? No. I've seen it on television. I've never seen it projected.
Night Shift with Henry Winkler, Michael Keaton, and Shelley Long. Mm-hmm. It was on so often I think I can still recite dialogue.
I have mixed feelings about that movie.
But, I like that movie.
I did the whole thing, like the talking into the tape recorder, like telling you to shut up.
And Legend of Billie Jean.
Oh, well, Dave's favorite movie.
I so wanted to be her. Fair is fair, is what the letter says. Are you going to be at Comic-Con? Clearly, this was a letter that was sent to us well before Comic-Con. The answer is no, we will not be at Comic-Con 2014.
Either.
Yeah.
Although, did you get that thing I sent you about Comic Fest?
Yeah, it's going to happen in October.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of like the idea that somebody's doing a comic book thing in San Diego to make up for the fact that Comic-Con isn't anymore.
Yeah. I'd love to meet you and take a photo and obnoxiously Instagram it. You guys are the awesome.
Well, that's very sweet.
That's from Lily in San Diego. Thank you, Lily.
Had we been at Comic-Con, we would have loved to have taken a picture with you.
I'm not on Instagram, and so any chance I have to be on someone else's Instagram, I'm pretty excited about. I don't even have the kind of phone that can allow me to be on Instagram.
You do not.
I do not. My phone is a dumb phone.
Yes. Not a smartphone.
No. The end. End of letters for
the
week.
Yeah. Okay. So we decided to skip DVD recommendations.
Because we had so many letters, many reviews.
But I will be posting a link to watching Come Back to the Five and Dime Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean on YouTube on our Facebook page. And if Prince Avalanche is on demand, I will post a link to that as well. So like our Facebook page to see all this action and follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can check into the show at getglue.com. You can subscribe to the program at iTunes for free, and you can also leave us a review there. And if you would, that would be great, because the more positive reviews we get, the more people find the show. You can stream us on Stitcher Radio or at thelounge.com. Linoleum-knife.com is coming soon.
Yes.
There's a placeholder there.
It's supposed to be. It should be up by now, but we've been running behind.
We promise.
It's like. It's so close.
Yes.
So close.
It's on the verge.
Yeah. Okay.
We want to thank Derek and Romaine for having us on this week. We've been doing that show once a month, so...
I got kicked off of the sports talk radio.
And what did you do? What did you do?
Here's what I did wrong. They called me to be on the air, live on the air.
Mm-hmm.
This was my second appearance on the air. They called me, and I was about 100 yards from the house with a bag of groceries.
Yeah, you huffed and you puffed.
And I ran, and I huffed and I puffed, and I'm on the air live going...
As though you were running a marathon.
And then, I'm running up the street and then up one flight of stairs. I lose my breath. I can barely construct a sentence. I'm live on the air.
I'm sure they thought you, great, we're going to have a live heart attack.
Yeah. And, they haven't called me back.
I haven't heard from them since.
You know what? I get it. I ruined their professional radio show moment for like 30 seconds. It was not smooth and slick in a major. It was a, you know, Washington D.C. is a major radio market.
Everybody relax.
I killed radio for like 45 seconds.
Well, we were on Derek and Remain this week, and one friend told us that we had finally ironed out our audio issues, and another friend said it sounded like we were calling in from
Beirut,
from Beirut on Al Jazeera. But you know. Onward and upward. We're happy to have us on every month. And
one ongoing success with Derek and Romaine.
Yes.
And one more failure.
Yes.
From me.
And we may be doing another radio show soon. And once we know about that, we'll tell you about it here and on our other various social media outlets. In the meantime, check out our friends in the podcast universe. Well, first of all, in the non-podcast universe, go to ChristyLemire.com and see what she's got brewing. And if you are a serious XM listener, check out Rotten Tomatoes Radio twice a week with our friends Matt Atchity and Gray Drake. And then podcast-wise, there's The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli. There's Cooking with Malcolm Ingram, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade. I went to their live show last night in Los Angeles. It was hilarious. Their special guest was Louis Fertel, who's been on this program and will ideally be on again. So that was a lot of fun, and they are terrific. Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast. Thanks again, Bibbs, for coming on last week. Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. We will catch you next time.
Goodbye.